Very fast. I want to present people who don't know us, and before that, to situate him economically speaking into a week, because he's not an astronaut without link with the Earth.
I hope.
So, I have to give an example. I followed the competition in Strasbourg for the rehabilitation of the Place Kléber, where a statue of General Kléber is in the center, and all around a big space. And they wanted to build the parking. And parking under the General Kléber is rude. It's a vulgarity. So I proposed to link that empty place that was too big to be human, to link that with something, with the city. So I proposed to imprint on the pavement all the map of the city itself, with the river Hill, who makes serpentine like that, but the river has to be calculated with the slopes, so that water pours and people may put their stockings into water, so that they are aware of the city. And the buildings have to be named by bronze letters.
Could be a very nice pavement.
And the jury, when I explained that to the jury, Katrin Volkmann, who was the mayor of Strasbourg, I addressed to her and I said, when you are tired, you go to the southeast and you sit on the University of Letter and Write. So it's just the height of a seat. She was ashamed, but everyone, well, I lost naturally. But years afterwards, people came to see me saying, it's a pity we didn't choose you because we have an abstract thing that doesn't signify anything. I speak about that, about a link between two things that have officially nothing to see together. An inner place and a plan of. So now I have two things, that is a week, Monday, Tuesday, this is a sacred affair, and 6 days, and as usual, the seventh is to rest, as anyone does. God the Father, the first showed the example. And that didn't change 7 days, they tried to make 10 days sometimes, in the French Revolution. It didn't work, that's seven, because of the seven. But it's a fact as such, and then I have friends first, the definition of family. They are friends. Certainly, I invite them to come to Venice, which is a wonderful landscape, and meet us without public. If there is public, it's better, but it's not necessary. Thing is that we have to stake something between us, and us is 200 persons, if necessary, or three of them, it doesn't matter. But the order of following each other is important. Because the one is linked to the other, the third, etc. And I don't want to begin with the soil mechanics, or the resistance of materials, or the narcissism of modern architects, etc. These are tasks, not linked to anything. I began with eco-ethology. And my friend Lunenburg said yesterday about animals, how they behave in certain circumstances with the acquisition and innate, what do you call that? You have a special disease. And for me, the animals obeying to natural or habitual laws and rules are exactly as inhabitants of the city, because they are naturally intelligent, the inhabitants, they are not animals. But they, as as inhabitants, they have no intelligence, because they have no culture, happily, they have no culture of habitat somewhere. So they have an instinct, and the instinct is not logic, not against logic, but more intuition and collective intuition. What we call atavism in town planning is something which is not very clear, but it's the most important because, you know, the intelligence, mechanical intelligence, the right brain, the left brain, the music, the etc. But the reptilian brain, which is here in the column, rules the emotions. And the emotions probably are the motif of the decision of 90%. So it's important to know what is not said, because they can't say it, they are not aware of it, but we have to guess that there is a huge amount of will, of good will, coming from the animal, etc., etc., that makes the decision. So we have to enter there and enter into their way of living. They know how to live, much more. And by the way, when you ask an inhabitant to design a house for himself, he will never design the Farnsworth house in Connecticut designed by Mies van der Rohe. No hope. That is, one glass makes the rectangle. That's a perfect shoebox, completely glazed. The kitchen and the bathroom is inside. It's a wonderful object, but it has nothing to see with nothing. The question is, if you have rabbits, where do you put your rabbit house in front of the Connecticut house of Mies van der Rohe? And it's not an insult to Mies van der Rohe, it's an example, but it's a reality. The add-on coming from peasantry tradition have the right to be there, to exist, to survive into the cities. The HLM Grand Ensemble cities are prefabricated. That means that they have, I had to rehabilitate a building of 350 meters long, it's silly that it's like that, which has one apartment multiplied by 350 meters, and each family had 2 meters. So 175, etc. Just mathematics. And all the windows on the ground floor were windows, never an open door. And I saw in Bordeaux in another scheme that people living with their window, with curtains, etc., very civilized, and they have to go out of that bedroom to cross the corridor, to cross the living room, to cross the entry, the hall and the entry, go make the round and cultivate flowers here. They do it. So the window is here and they have a little garden there because the parents or the grandparents were peasants. And that culture is killed by the architect. No, by the architecture. Let's be kind. If all those motifs you want to escape from, you refuse it, you have a theoretical family which has no link. So that's ethology. Faster. If you see that, the result is that the city is a living being, because it's more than just an agglomeration of families or houses. They have interlinks that makes a more complex thing than the two houses together. And that's a living being. And Patrick Jets built a tower in the city of Dunfermline, just a tower to invite the citizens of that little city to see that city from above and to show how that human being, city, is working from above. With a glimpse for that, but he was a biologist, that's a co-biologist. After that, I speak about eco-urban decolonization. By the way, all urban acts are colonial by definition and by rule. Against the law, who demands that you have to question the inhabitants. Question, but not, you are not obliged to listen to them, you have to question them. So they say something and people do a bunch of propositions that is given to the architect. And in the Netherlands where we work, they have great factories where they build architects, they produce architects, and they teach a horrible word, which is a concept. So you have what they call a problem. A house is not a problem, it's a liturgy. When they have what they call a problem, they force the student architect to build for himself a concept to apply to that and stick to that until the realization. Inhabitants south of north, doesn't matter, that's the concept who counts. Well, that's silly because it's a human living, and the decolonization, I have the experience, it's somewhere here, of designing a city in Central Africa for the president of the Republic of Rwanda, Kayibanda Gregoire. I say the name because it's not utopian. Utopian is a dream outside the world. I don't like that. It's more than Café du Commerce. They are always right. They do the thing. He asked me to design, he received through Belgium a building, presidency, the administration. He wanted to be alone in a hill 5 kilometers from Kigali, which is his capital, saying that he has not the energy resisting to the colonialists there, and he wants to be alone here, surrounded by African people with an African form, urban form. It doesn't exist. Contemporary urban forms in Africa are colonial, occidental, portuary cities, commercial cities, administrative cities, religious, or ancient cities. The problems are new, but nothing contemporaneous and authentic coming from what I guess is the inner civilization of Africa. They had no occasion to say anything. It collapsed, don't worry. But it's a reality because people involved in that adventure were real. Well, after that I say that the landscape is a being again, which forms itself. It creates itself, not the gardener. He helps when he is clever. And the landscape architect is the alone human being who never makes any landscape, because he makes a geological form, and everything that goes out he kills, always. That's a form, that's a concept against nature, always, with natural beings. Except some miracles, Louis Leroy in north of Holland, who let his garden do what he wants. And it became a paradise, what he calls a green cathedral. And he lives there. He has worked 60 years on his garden, letting the garden do. Another is Gilles Clément, who is invited, I don't remember when, who is the alone landscape architect, he doesn't want to be called that, who helps a piece of nature with what it exists to be better, to be improved by themselves. It's a landscape engineer, no, landscape human, no more. And the Saturday, no, that was with Luigi Cavallari, and the Saturday has no precise theme altogether, and is based a little on that philosopher, I don't know if you know him, a German one, Peter Sloterdijk, who has written a treatise of the reason cynical, or the cynical reason, saying roughly that intelligence, mechanical intelligence, is one part of the human body, but the rest of the human body is much more important than with the Greek text of philosophers. Socrates asks to Diogenes, Diogenes with his barrel, something, and he answers with the noise of the body. Not the reasoning, but what he is against it, so that sort of mechanical reasoning. That's what he wrote, and recently, 5 years ago, something, he made a lecture in Switzerland, and then he published the text of the lecture, and the title is horrifying. It is Rules for a Human Park, as if humans were a cattle that has to be dumped, to be ruled, to be organized, because they are not human beings. And he says that humanism was born with the writings and reading. They formed a society. It's more a dream than a history, historical thing. They form a society, a group, completely open, because if you learn to read, you make part, you are a part of the group. And they correspond not alone by voice, but by paper, etc. And a Greek may write a letter to a friend, it's a humanism gesture, or to a Roman, and he says everything's organized spontaneously to that, because that Roman finds always a Greek one who translates to that, and there are two, etc. And every century made a little more precise, more complex, until Middle Ages, until Renaissance, Enlightenment, 19th century, 20th, etc., until the war. And suddenly he says that exactly in 1946, I don't know why, he doesn't explain why, it has been reversed. Humanism became criminal because of technology, who forced humanism to improve the society, the world, the plants, GMO, genes, etc., to improve nature, in order to obey to the mathematical or commercial will of the society, until eugenics, that is to sort in the population of human beings the ones who doesn't serve to anyone, the mad people, they were killed under the Nazi. The illness without healing possible, killed, let them die. The crippled disappeared. The cigoyner, the
gypsies, yeah,
were killed. The Jewish were killed. And the bad socialist Germans were killed the first, 1 million. You forget it. The first enemies inside Germany was the socialists. And they killed 1 million. They don't speak about that. But it's a system. It's not randomly decided. And that was condemned hatefully by all the world against the Nazi. But it comes back. And recently in France, they have a project going to the kindergartens to take samples of cells from the children to analyze the ADN, DNA, to see if they find criminal genes. They say that exists, probably they are wrong, but they try to prevent the crime through the childhood. Some feel that they have no right to know it and to make that research. So that's eugenics. Well, that's sort of it. My job is to guess, what about architecture? Architecture, well, let us speak about materials. We don't find any materials that were same 100 years in the last century. You don't find any more. Wood is not wood anymore, it's a protection, chemical protection. Glass is different. The bricks are not made with a foot or hand, but with a machine. The texture of the argile, the clay, is different. The resistance to the rain is different. Everything is different, but so slowly that the architects didn't see it. You have other protections. And all the chemical materials or the concrete materials, etc. There is nothing more than was available a century ago. That's for the material, which is not the most important thing. The shape of the house, the architect is paid to have his concept and force a sort of a functional, as they say, plan with the form of a tree, they explain. The ancients, and then you have the living room or the kitchen or the stair or the toilet, but you have no door between the living room and the kitchen, just a hole. Mm. And between the kitchen and bathroom also nothing. Or from one bedroom to another you have no door. Even if your baby is crying there, you have to go to the public room and then to the child. It's the definition from Oslo to Algier. It's the same organization of the plan. If you let people, we tried it, design their own home, they never do that. Well, why should I force these people to live in my concept, which is rational in my view, but irrational in their view? Let us try to understand what they, and if it's possible, I have to judge if it's possible, we try to do it. About town planning, that's the same. Let them propose their own disorder, and finally we will have a thing which is not dead, but we will gain fertility. Things that are moving by themselves, rehabilitating by themselves. And finally, as an architect, I have to say that suddenly you have a strange feeling being useful to something. That's it. You too.
Okay, yeah. Right. Well, I should first of all thank Lucien for inviting me here. And it's, I think, the first time that I and Lucien Peter Hübner have been together.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a great reason for being here. I've actually written about both of them. I think it's 20 years now since I translated Lucien's book, Composants, which was called The Architecture of Complexity, which was the work stemming out of what he'd done in the early 70s in Brussels, the Meme, the student housing, which was produced by a kind of complex, almost random system of participation, and made a building which was really almost catastrophically untidy by the ideas of then. I was just coming to the end of my student time. We couldn't believe this thing we saw published there. That the vitality of it, in comparison with the standard architecture of that time. So, with the translation of the book, we established a contact which has gone on to and fro. I visited his project, I wrote about them in the Architectural Review. And then in 1983, I was called on by the Architects Journal to go to Stuttgart to see another desperately untidy, naughty building made by Peter Hübner and Peter Sulzer, which I have some slides of in a while. where they let 30 architectural students loose to design their own hostel, each room different. And it's really bad in terms of stylistic consistency. Every possible kind of architecture, they didn't have a chance to look at each other's beforehand, so they couldn't be harmonized. So it broke all the rules about architectural good taste, but it makes the best architectural hostel I've ever visited. So I've been very interested all these years in this way of generating architecture by asking the people and by discovering the forms that might be implied by what they want, rather than imposing some idea of one's own. And I'm also a historian of the modern movement. I've written monographs on architects like Scharoun and Haring and Asplund. But this participative side of my interest has continued all the way along, and it's really been accompanied by another one, which is an interest in what people did before architects came in to ruin their lives, how they built for themselves, and so what architecture had been under earlier societies. And I'm going to connect the two up with this argument. So when Lucian invited me, I thought I would set out to answer this question of why is participation important, and why should we be going back to a participative architecture? I say back to because I think originally all architecture was participative, inevitably. So, next slide, please. So first of all, a quotation from Churchill after the war, when the Parliament had been bombed and it was going to be reconstructed, the House of Commons, he said, "First we shape our buildings, and then our buildings shape us." So we designed them in a certain way, and then they forced us to behave in a certain way. That's the idea behind it. And I think at the literal level, the modernist functionalists thought they could force people to behave in a certain way by making a certain design. It's not altogether true, because very few buildings are coercive. Prisons, perhaps, you can lock a door. But otherwise, you can't force people to behave in a particular way. But it's not so much true at that very literal level. It's true in a much more complex way, that the buildings set up certain, they imply certain relationships. This Commons Chamber was based on a chapel. The first version was made in an old chapel, and therefore you get two sides. And therefore, in England, we have a two-party system. It's very difficult for a third party to get in, but certainly it's reinforced by this duality. This line on the floor is determined by the distance in between two sword lengths, because they're not supposed to step beyond this point if they're and get into a battle with each other. Another very important point for this house is that when they vote, they walk through a door, and there are two doors to walk through, whether they're voting yes or no. They don't press a button, so it's the action of walking through a door that defines what they do. And so the rituals of the parliamentary behaviour are reflected in the building, in the organisation of the building, and that is important. If you change the building, then the rituals have to change as well, or they may only go on with difficulty. So next slide, please. Architects have been onto this idea for quite some time, and one of the clearest about this was our 19th century architect Pugin, who wrote a book called Contrasts, where he was trying to prove in 1836 that the medieval way of building was appropriate for modern times, and we should build Gothic, because they were much more religious and Catholic, and they treated people better. So there was a mixture of his religious and his architectural convictions.
But he did drawings like this. These are comparative treatments of in poor houses for poor people. And the top one is the modern poorhouse, and the bottom one is the good old medieval poorhouse, which is his positive example. And first of all, here's the diet. These people are getting ham and cheese, where up at the top they just have some kind of gruel. In the middle here, at the top, when they die, their
coffins are taken away for dissection,
whereas in the Gothic times they got a very good burial. And this is the enforcement of discipline. Up there you can see there is a prison, and there are manacles and various instruments of enforcement, whereas here he's being told off in the church and made to promise to God that he won't do wrong anymore.
And next, please.
Next slide. And these are the accompanying illustrations to the two architectures. So the upper one, that's the modern forehouse, and the lower one is the ancient forehouse, the good example. Next, please. So if we enlarge the modern one, the modern poorhouse is based on ideas of prisons and of the Bentham Panopticon, the kind of utilitarian ideal of central supervision. So you can see all the inmates. And he is deliberately connecting the poorhouse with the prison because people's freedom was restricted in that way.
Next, please. Whereas the old one is based on the monastery and the monastic cloister with the dominance of the chapel, and is an articulated complex. So I think Pugin, just with these drawings, is making very, very strongly the case that the architecture reflects the society. And I think he was completely right about that.
Next, please. So when one starts to go into the examples from the anthropological record, we find time and time again there's a spatial organization that reflects the social organization. This is a Mongolian yurt, the plan, and it's a circular tent, and it has one entrance here, and opposite the entrance is the altar, so that's the place of religious observance, whereas in the center is the hearth, which is what keeps everybody warm. And then on this side it's men, and on this side it's women. And there are particular places where members of the family and guests and so on sit, so that there's a place of honour on the men's side, between
the altar and the hearth. So the whole of space inside the house is given a kind of hierarchical meaning.
And the same kind of thing operates at the level of the village. So this is from Levi-Strauss. It's the plan of the Bororo village. And the interesting thing about this one is that they are in two moieties, that side and that side of the central axis. And the people on this side of the village marry the people on that side of the village. So if you're born on this side of the village, when you're, as a man, when you reach puberty, you live in the men's house in the middle, and then you marry a girl from the other side, and then when you die, the people from the original side conduct your funeral. And Levi-Strauss tells, in Tristopit, how the Silesian missionaries came and told them that they were wicked and that they should rearrange their village on a grid. And when they rebuilt the village on a grid, the whole social structure fell apart because they no longer knew who they were. Who they were was no longer defined by where they lived. And I think it's very interesting to speculate on how that could have come about, because I think there must have been a decision sometime to combine the people of the two villages, and somebody must have actually made a kind of design decision that we'll live in this half and you live in the other half. But I don't think that those sort of stories
are recoverable, because it's an oral culture and we don't know what happened. So just two examples from the anthropological literature, but there are thousands everywhere across the world. When you get into detail, that's what you find. Next, please. So the Dogon is a particularly rich example in Mali, and first of all there's the village, and the village is supposed to have a plan which is based on a human body, so that it follows that pattern. Very difficult to see in many of them, but it was told by a Dogon elder that that's what the arrangement was, and so he certainly had a version of an ideal village. And it's, I think, quite telling that the men's meeting house, which is where all the decisions are taken, so it's a very good example of one here, is at the head point of the village. There are very distinct building types at this stage. So there are large family houses and less important family houses. There are granaries, which are like this, because the agriculture is the most important thing, and the granaries are in four compartments with the four different kinds of grain, so that they can preserve them. And this building is kind of parliament for the meetings, and is a very distinct type, has columns which represent the ancestors. It also has this very heavy roof of thatch, obviously far thicker than you would ever need from a pragmatic point of view. So you get a distinct and coherent series of building types in the village. Next, please. Very, very clear derivation of architectural iconography. We wonder, with the classical tradition, there have been so many reinterpretations of what a Doric or an Ionic column mean, that there's uncertainty about those. But when you go back to the Dogon and the oral sources of 50 years ago, these are very clearly intended to be the ancestors, everybody says so, and these are the 80 ancestors going back to the primordial couple that are represented here. So one can say that the beginning of architectural ornament and decoration came from this kind of symbolism. Next, please. And then the house has this geometric form with a central square space and four columns, and it has quite complex symbolism, which is described by the Dogon elder, which actually is orientated and represents the cosmos, but also represents the conjugation of man and woman. The house is also anthropomorphic. The tower at the end is supposed to, which is the kitchen, is supposed to represent the head, and the breathing of the woman, which comes out of the top in the form of the smoke from the fire. So the symbolism is operating at several levels. I mean, explicitly in the form of the sculptural objects, which are meant to represent the ancestors, but also implicitly in the organisation of the buildings, and the geometry of the buildings, and the geometry of the house, making a square. Next, please. Is connected with ideas about the world system. This is a kind of idealized granary, and with laying out fields, which have to be, so the beginning of geometry is the laying out of a field, and with weaving, and is therefore represented in the blanket, the most important form of which is the funeral pall, as seen there. Next, please. So there are examples like that, but then coming nearer to the present day, you can also look at the way that we eat, the way that dining is organised, because meals are rituals in just about all cultures. So how they're organised and what kind of utensils you have and what kind of tables you have tells you
it meshes with the table manners of the people and what they believe about the food and this socialising that accompanies the food.
And meals is just one very clear example. Next, please.
I talked about the meaning so far as though it was something that was static and fixed.
And the research that Stephen Hugh Jones did about Capernaum houses in Amazonia
suggests that that actually the meanings are more complicated than that, and that the house has different readings at different times when different rituals are being enacted. So that it's not just a question of a passive relationship, it's an active one. That people have to be told as they grow up by their parents what all this means. The decoration on the house, which is a clue to the to their mythology, how the world is organised, but also the organisation of the house, where you're allowed to go and where you and where you don't go. And you learn that as a child, and then you use the house in terms of that reading. And those readings can be complex and they can be multiple. But in order for it to work, there has to be that complicity, that interaction. Next, please. And here again, there are all kinds of symbolisms involved, so that the house represents an idea of the cosmos, where you find yourself in relation to it. There's also an idea that the giant anaconda is represented going down the middle of the house, forming the main axis, because that's the most important mythological beast. There are places where different kinds of rituals take place at different times. Next, please. That's the accurate plan drawing from Stephen Hugh Jones, and there you can see a picture of it from the air. It's a house which is lived in by a group of families and is founded by one man, who's typically an elder brother, who moves in with his wife, and he lives here, and then the other compartments are the families of his brothers, normally. And it lasts until he dies, at which point they bury him and they move away and build another one. So it has that limited life which is linked with one man. And the organisation is very strongly that it's hierarchically from front to back, and it gets more and more private as you come through to the headman's quarters here. But it's also very strongly male and female, because this public side is male and has a straight front, and this is the female rear side, which connects with the gardens where they cultivate their crops, because it's a mixture of women cultivating crops and men going out and fishing and hunting. So it's a dual food provision. And all that is reflected in this house, and this is their whole world. And they don't have any writing, so they need this as a way of conveying what their world is and of converting it from the jungle. Next, please. So, these principles operate cross-culturally, but always very specific. Because oral cultures was a primary mnemonic, a primary way of remembering things. You don't have writing, then you inscribe it in the building, and you can say to the children that it represents the god or the mythical creature or whatever it happens to be. Now, this is an example from southern China, and these bridges are some of the most elaborate bridges in the world. Not many bridges in many places have roofs, and these have multiple roofs, and also they're sometimes, quite often, built over very small streams, and sometimes they don't have very much traffic over them. And they are paid for entirely by small villages that live there. So I have a PhD student studying this, and she brought this along as a question, why do they build these things? So we made an investigation. We discovered that actually there are several reasons. One is because of Chinese geomancy, feng shui, because the energy of the earth goes into the river, and where the river goes down the valley, the natural energy is in danger of flowing away and needs to be stopped, so it's very propitious to put a bridge in a particular place. It's part of a very complex system of siting things. And the second is because it's a great big symbol of a rite of passage, that it symbolizes a transition from one land to another, which is something that is found in their ideas about death. But also, if you want to get pregnant or to have a successful birth, you go and make observances on this bridge. And also, a woman who's going to be married has to be taken across the bridge on the day before. There are numerous observances to do with that. And there are also altars for various local gods going across the bridge. So they put an enormous amount of time and effort into making these bridges in order to fulfill those aspects of their cosmology. And the bridges are, in some cases, almost practically redundant, but there are bridges a very short distance apart. They certainly don't have a very strong utilitarian usage. Next, please. So there's a bridge in relation to a village, and this shows some of the construction. Next, please. These are typical houses from these Dong people in southern China. Next, please. In making their houses, let alone the bridge, they have the most complex building rituals I've yet come across. Because this is another very neglected area. I found there is no general book on building rituals. And we used to have in Europe foundation stone layings and toppings out. But it's become less and less the case. I think we do it very, very little in England now. But in China, even to build a family house 50 years ago was hugely elaborate. This is a house with the frame complete. There's a celebration going on the ridge pole at the top, and the placing of the ridge pole is hugely important. But I've got actually a list of all the rituals that take place during the building of the house, and there are 13 of them. They start with the master carpenter being invited to the house to have a meal with the family, which is something of a ceremonial meal, where the need for the house... Oh no, come on, yes, you can move, have the next one, please. Yeah, like just as well. Yes, so I've got the brief leadership here. Yes, the carpenter comes to a family meal. And the main decisions are made. And then the next thing is for the wood to be found. And the wood has to be found in the right places, and the correct rites have to be done in the forest to propitiate the spirits of the mountain and the spirits of the tree. If you don't do that, you'll have bad luck. And the central column is a particular tree. And also it should be accompanied by a shorter tree, so it should be the male tree of a pair in their interpretation. Before it can be cut down, there has to be a ceremonial wielding of three axe cuts, the first three axe cuts before it's cut down, and various incantations have to be made at that point. Then they have to take the trees back to the village, and they have to be carried in a particular way, and they mustn't be put down. And when they get to the building site, the direction in which they're placed is important. Then there's number three, decide the placing with the
sorry, then there's number four, sorry. They invite the trestle before carpentry begins, which is... The trestles are what they set up the beams on when they're going to cut them, to make them, to put the joints in them and get them ready to put them together. But before that process starts, the trestles have to be set up in the right orientation. The orientation of everything is important in the Feng Shui system. Yes, besides the placing of the house with the Feng Shui master I was missing out, that's very important, the orientation of the house, to take readings of its relation to the rivers, mountains and so on. Mark out the timbers followed by a ceremonial meal. So marking out the timbers with ink in order to decide the construction of the house and all the jointing. Making up the frame, this takes place one day before the setting up of the frame, and what I haven't mentioned is that for every one of these routines there has to be a propitious day. Certain days of the month are unlucky and others are lucky, because there is a specific time system set up in the almanac. And then the main beam is so important, an element at the top of the house, a sort of key element that there's a tradition that that has to be stolen. It can't be among the other timbers. So that makes a magical appearance overnight. Next, please. And then you get to the setting up of frame, and among these people it has to be done before the sun rises, so that the sun can shine across the new house. So they have to sacrifice a cock to banish the bad spirits, and then the frame is set up at the dawn, the sun rises on the assembled house, and they have the raising the beam ceremony, the ridge beam, and the leading craftsman has to do that, and two assistants, and the two assistants have to perform particular roles, and they all have various things to sing, and there have to be offerings made on an altar underneath, and so on. And then there's a setting up house feast. And then later than that, there's the ceremony for inhabiting the house, opening the welcome door, which is the first entry to the house, welcoming of the owner, and the first lighting of the fire. So this kind of thing was probably widespread. The Chinese example is the most elaborate one I've ever found. But what you see is that the effort of building a house involves the whole community. Everybody comes in these various stages, and they can't help knowing what a house means. And also all the parts of the house have particular names and particular significance. So the house is really knit into the community in this process. Next, please. Yep, so the house is inscribed in the culture and in the landscape, given its unique place. Next, please. Okay, so that's the case from anthropology, and I think there could be endless examples of that. What's happened with architecture? Modernity has undermined all this. So I've got a few illustrations from Rolf Keller's classic, Bauen als Umweltzerstörer, Building as Pollution, 1973, which I think is still strong stuff. Pointing out, for example, that the same kind of forms are used for the same kind for all these different purposes, and it's very similar to factory farming. I don't have to underline the point. Next, please. And then, you know, the problem of repetition and the problem of selfishness, all these kind of selfish objects which have nothing to do with each other. Next, please. And of course there's been a fair amount of complaint about this, but the problem is not just architectural style. It's the whole apparatus that is placed between building and user. So we have, first of all, specialist designers. You can't build a house these days, certainly not in Europe, without having somebody to draw it in advance. And that means that the ordinary person can't do it, so they have to call in some kind of specialist.
And it also means that the house has to exist in drawings and be judged in drawings before it gets built. And it may be that judgments about houses in drawings aren't very accurate or very good, and it may be that actually with vernacular houses beforehand, you could build perfectly good houses without ever predicting what they were going to look like. Because builders knew approximately what they were going to look like and people didn't worry about it. Certainly it doesn't seem to have done our landscape any good to have had aesthetic planning control. It's just got worse since aesthetic planning control came in. So these specialist designers are necessary, and now they're necessary for everything, because you can't otherwise get planning permission, money, get through building regulation. And then there's factory production as opposed to building, because all the materials have changed and it's easier to do things in factories, and so all the old craft processes have more or less disappeared, and you can't get an ordinary builder who lives down your street to do your house. Planning permission I already talked about. Building regulations become more and more numerous every year, and they decide where you spend your money, because something is going to be unsafe or unhealthy, that I have to have a certain number of square meters, or I have to have a fan in my bathroom so that I don't have nasty smells in there. That's an example of something which is not actually harmful, but which is part of the rules of polite society. And then the finance and resale value comes in. Quite often people are more interested in the financial value of their house than in what it's like to live in. That's increasingly the case at the moment. But also, the people you borrow the money from may refuse to finance it unless they think it's resellable. And the last one, which is most pernicious at the moment, the transfer of attention to the entity image, that's affecting all of us, that we are looking at pictures of houses in magazines. And students who looked at the catalogues for houses that you could buy from major house builders, and on the first page was just an image of the old village nearby, which had nothing to do with it, but was to make you think that you were living in a nice old village. And then on the second page was a picture of the living room with all the latest furniture and electric gadgets, which to imply that you would have these things if you lived in the house. And the plan of the house was very much later on, and was very minor. And also there was a watercolour elevation of the house, which showed it as though it was completely isolated and not a few feet away from the next one. So it was entirely being filled on the value of an image. And then increasingly the images belong to the world of magazines and the world of television and the world of the computer. So that we confuse these images with the reality of habitation. And I think here this pavilion was a kind of desperate attempt to remind everybody of the realities of habitation. Next, please. And why participation is necessary is because when people are no longer given the choice, they lose interest and they feel alienated. So they have awful architecture, but they just put up with it. And this is another couple of pages from Rob Keller's book. Next, please. So there was this possibility has opened up, and we all knew Walter Segal in London, who in the 60s, actually, the end of the 60s, he needed to make a very cheap house, and he designed a house just using materials that you could get off the shelf. And then he found that it was much more durable and possible for permanent living than he thought, so he started to let people build their own houses by this method. And eventually this was taken up by one of the boroughs of London, the housing system. Here's Walter, and this is the kind of house. And these were
poor people on the housing list who had very low wages and wouldn't have the possibility of owning a house probably in their lifetime on the basis of the usual system, but with the self-building they could do it. But first of all, he thought it was socially and economically a good idea, but then he discovered very soon that the people were much more interesting than the houses, that all the time he was going on the site, he was talking about their families and their relationships and not about the house. And that the way this had changed their lives, it had opened up possibilities, it had given them back possession of their own space, was the most important discovery. And this has spread, and it goes on. Next, please. Oh no, this is one more. Here they are, the happy inhabitants. This is the simplicity of the system. It was a very, very cleverly devised to be as simple as possible. Next, please. And so it went on, and his work inspired Peter's and Peter Sulzer's student hostel in 1983. Which was designed and built and then lived in by the students, and which still exists today, and which is an extraordinary amalgam of different kinds of buildings with the students trying lots of different experiments. Next, please. And so the core of it followed the Walter Siegel system, but then the rooms were designed one by one by the students. And then, I don't know whether you'll be talking more about this tomorrow, Peter, but I just wanted to show this as a turning point, really, which it was in your career, because up before this time, Peter was a hero of prefabrication. He made prefabricated bathroom systems and things of that sort. He was very successful in that area. And then he also had this discovery, the same discovery as Siegel, that this social dimension of building makes it much more interesting and much more engaging, became then much more, became dominant in his work and has gone on ever since. And it has to do with engaging the people and the place and the circumstances, rather than imposing something. And it has to do with dialogue. That's the most important thing. That people can have some determination of the kind of housing that they get, and that they understand what they're getting, and they can alter it if they want to. And it also has a great degree of complexity about it because of all the individual decisions that went in. And I think what comes across from Lucien's contribution and all his work is that complexity in itself is of huge importance. Just that kind of simplicity of those repetitive modernist works is the enemy, that actually imposes a uniformity that makes everybody feel that they're the same, like soldiers lined up on parade. Next, please. So this is inside the student hostel. And next. And some more. And curiously, with this building, now it still exists and it's been there for 23 years. And it must have been through 10 generations of students. That is, they lived in it for the time when they were students, and then they left and others took over, and they weren't architectural students. I think the last time we looked, there was only one architectural student. And it kept going, and it runs itself. There are 30 of them, they don't have a warden, nobody bossing them about, they make the decisions, they decide on the next people who are going to take up rooms there, and there's a waiting list for it. Next, please. And another one, please. Yes, next. And so there were the other
Hübner project, which he's probably going to tell you about. And I've made my argument, really, now. And since I didn't know when I was first putting them together that you were going to be here, so I won't follow with all the rest of your work, I think.
You have to read your book, all this work will not be shown. Too many. All the time.
Can you quickly go through the rest?
This was true, if you go back.
That's a thought,
yeah.
And I expect you'll be talking about that one tomorrow. Yeah, I think, this one is probably a good example to end on, because it was a building for a school hall, and they didn't have any money at all, so they had to raise the money, and there was an uncertainty about it for quite a long time. The thing had to get going, enthusiasm had to build, and then they had to raise more money. But they were carrying on events inside the building during the stages of its construction in order to raise more money, but also making people more aware of the presence of the building. So that by the time it was finished, it was already inscribed in the locality. And in a sense, the struggle of not having the money to start with, but having to find it through all kinds of donations and raising it locally, made the building belong more intensely to the community than would have been the case if the state had given them the money and they'd built a straightforward building and handed it over.
And the school is sure that the whole building process changed the school at all. The process of building the tower changed the school.
Changed the school.
All the type of self-help or anticipation building changes people to something else, of the society, of the school. This is important. And the writing is the keeps belonging to the whole process, I think, in the Chinese. Certain point. This is, I think, we deeply need more rituals and beliefs.
Can I have the last slide of the list. So, oh no, that's sorry. Can you go back to the last slide? Because I just had a summary. Oh. That's right, yeah, that'll do. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, leave it there. Okay. So, these are the products, really. It produces differentiated and varied buildings in response to purpose. So the real problem with the modernist buildings of the 50s and 60s, that they are not differentiated and varied enough. They are too monotonous and repetitive. So you get the differentiation and the variety. Secondly, it initiates a feedback loop between building and using, permitting a dialogue, so that the users have a say in the process, and maybe the next time round you make something different. And I think this kind of imposition through the bureaucratic machine of the repetitive modernist building doesn't allow for this feedback loop to take place. Thirdly, it regenerates building rituals which engage the users even before completion. So I think this is something that heals the wound of making a new building, because making a new building you deprive people of the old one, you change the city, so it is a destructive as well as a constructive act. And if the people are involved in that, then they can be involved in a positive way, and they can anticipate the coming of the new building, and then they can enjoy it. And even in participation in fundraising helps to make a building belong to its users. And there were lots of aspects of that. In one of Peter's buildings, a primary school, the parents of the children agreed to get involved in work on the garden. And because they had agreed to give so many hours of their time, that had to be equaled by a similar amount of money from the state. So they got more money to build the school, and the parents were obliged to come along and make the garden. And in making the garden, they got to know each other, and then they felt proud of the garden. So it actually improved things on several levels at once. And the sense of belonging encourages actions of care and maintenance. And we certainly found this with a whole lot of Peter's buildings, at least. That you go back and they're looked after, and people say, we built it, and we repair it, and so on. I don't think any of them are in really bad condition.
No one.
Yeah.
And in most societies, the middle class, very few nine class, has the youth, maybe 10 years old, saying, we built the house, but the house was built 10 years ago. It makes a difference, that's nice. But they are really proud that they did it. Yeah, psychologists of Switzerland, which met this building, and I didn't ask, they asked me, because twice in two of this project, they got the same answer. And the question, why there's such a deep relation between a house must be answered. Maybe there's an emotional answer on it. I think people are deeply needing closeness to houses because they have a hope that they can survive. And this is so deeply in the genes already. The need of being having closeness and having houses that the children start building children houses which are blanket over and so on and so on. And in modern society, we are losing this responsibility for being able to build, design a house. And when we started in this early career, we had these pictures you showed, giving these examples. We saw that the active help, the self-help, is the most important in this sort of participation, and more we build bigger and bigger projects, that the active building of the house is done by craftsmen, it's lost, it's not done by self-help, and the size of the stage, that means the even more important is the participation and the planning. We have to ask people, and we have to listen to them, and to give sort of Christian state of happiness. You must be humble, you can listen to people, you must be able to listen to them and give people the feeling that they get to own house. Peter wrote a book on my work 2 years ago already, text ready. The book will be out next half year, hopefully.
You said it, but I want to promise.
He's a big book on this.
Peter, do you have kids?
The trial, all the buildings are not buildings, or buildings of my office, and not buildings of the people. They are buildings of the people.
the thing that they're feeling of their mind feeling, but they are not totalitarian way, my will, that they look like I want an house or something.
Yeah, but nobody could.
But this is a transformation of the visions of the people.
But nobody would invent such an extraordinary mixture of buildings as just went past on the screen.
But they gave the task.
Yeah.
They gave the idea. We are absolutely, all of my office at the moment, all the younger, like our sons and partners, we are absolutely sure that we will find a solution. That we mustn't go into a participation process with a prejudice. And we know that actually be naked, thinking nothing before. Everything we think before is a prejudice, and we know already how it would look like. We won a competition in Holland, I will show it tomorrow. We had 500 people participating in this process. And we won the project, the competition, just telling we don't want to think about it, we don't want to draw any single part of the house. We just say we want to do it with the people who are in after the exploding of the firework factory there. And the whole part of the city of Enkiri was torn by war attacks. And the people who live there lived up their lives. We don't have the chance to ask all the people, we do not find the right answer. And even in that case, in the foreign country, not knowing the language, it works. Works if you give the people the feeling that you are listening and taking them serious. And then the heat of wishes, which are absolutely unbelievable, that it will ever find any solution. But even of this total chaos, Eastern Europe, total chaos, thousands of ideas, highways, round houses, starlight houses, fire houses, balloon houses, materials like 1, 2, 3, for everything. Everybody wants to sit on the stage, the main street, the best area. We want this place, and this place. There are 35 parties which have to be arranged on that. And then, 3, 4 weeks later, over 2 days, maybe 2 months later, we were absolutely fascinated. Everybody was happy. One was sitting in the first floor, everything was arranged because all the people knew about the problem that it's not easy to make a good design for a small part of the city. Just the knowledge that this is a difficult way, and they knew, okay, if I do this, and all the complexity you find in the end, a sort of self-building system, like a nation. That's a self-building system, we by which call this. And this is really fascinating. It doesn't need me, design, the design prima donna, make the architect the prima donna. The architect has to be the pro-master.
Enabler, yes, really. But it also requires a lot of willpower and skill and courage, because I mean it is your work wouldn't have happened without you, and you took a lot of risks, and there's quite a lot of you in it as well in the end.
There are some two kinds of biographers that can show them all. There are some two kinds of biographers that can mention places who
but I mean I think also it's it's been a resistance movement. Because always when I always had to invite Lucien to, when I wanted in the School of Architecture to have a lecture about architecture and politics, Lucien is always the choice, because he goes in a very gentle and civilized way into these situations, but with complete courage to say the unsayable and to
push it in a completely new direction, and so exposing the forces which are there, which nobody challenged, and all the forces which make the modern environment so dreary and dreadful, which are, you know, all like the building regulations, all supposed to be there to protect us for good reasons, but actually have a negative effect because they undermine the delicate balance of decision making. You know, they force you to overvalue certain risks above others. And I think you've both been very courageous in going against the grain by doing this. I mean, most architects haven't done that.
We know that.
And that's been so. That's been a strong kind of the political aspect of it. And I don't know whether it will ever break through. But it's very important to have some examples to show the possibility.
In the moment, it seems more to be exotic than about the end. The question is how you can, or in an office, how can, say, work grow, and one project is coming there and the other, but you can see the old times, you see. When we won the competition of the Gate School, Lucien was in the one of the judges, huh? And he said, I won this, that written story, and in the book, actually later, there's a book on the market where children build their school, and there's the whole story written.
Yeah,
down,
let's see. Now again,
Lucien said, this guy can write such a story, knows how to do it.
Can you, Lucien, can you tell us?
That was that always to do something.
Can you tell us from your side what it was like?
this jury.
The what?
The jury for the Gelsenkirchen School.
Yeah, it was funny. He proposed a school. A wing along the street, an inner street with wings for the 8 classes.
30 classes.
30.
Six.
Yeah.
Six wings with 30 classes. 5 inches.
Everything was well designed, but one wing was designed, and the others were designed with a dotted line. And he explained that he wanted to have other architects to do it. And all the jury in Germany said, this is not allowed. It's an architect that we need, not a bunch of other architects with our unknown for the moment. This is the Bella Ras, Harmon Street. I do agree. If you show me where it is written in your law of the jury that it's forbidden to say so and to do it. But Harmon Street hesitated and then they said, probably it's not forbidden. But it has not to be done yet. Why? Because frankly, there are some things, and he will do it. And the other projects were interesting. Not the fact that he proposed an adventure, a process that the others made good architecture, to say generally, but their projects without the random and the unknown effects of people that are not yet aware, are not yet there, and will have an action of it, so it's not possible to define it.
It was even worse because, if you don't remember right, the main street, he wanted to have the buildings in the main street done by different offices.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, it was an invited competition until the over the 8 can even take one part of this, and the classes, this shall be built after the design of the children. And finally, 30 classes were designed by 1,000 children. Can you tomorrow? I will show
go back.
I will show
you. Yeah, more. Yeah, go on through.
This is already a bit more.
No back.
This is it's a fascinating tool, and it is changing the life of the school society, or it's creating, especially this way of living in the school. It's one of the social conflict points in the rural region. There's 30% of unemployed people there and 30% Turkish people there. This is a multicultural school with 30% Turkish and they are not Christian. It's a Christian church, but they have this multicultural aspect, and this is an interesting aspect. And the difficulty in this project was to believe as architecture, as an architect, that this is possible. It took 4 years for me to get the financing clear, and at that time I had some sleepless nights because I was still not sure if it is possible to design a classroom house with 30 young children, 10 years old, children, and it works tremendously well. We built a certain different classroom houses, one looking at the other, all in the same room.
Another side issue of this is the whole question of how many buildings is a school. Yeah, because the modernists might assume it's one building. And, you know, here it's a whole group of buildings, and the group of buildings articulate the different functions, so you know what is a theatre and what
in the entire screen we, as we are not allowed to take a different paper offices, every single building in this street, 11 of them, is done by one architect or everybody was responsible for his house, and they could speak with each other, but this made a difference. In the end, it turned out to be a very cheap tool. It doesn't cost money, you know. It was calculated at 16 million German marks, 30,000 euros, and we had to build it for 22,000 million euros, and we built it exactly for that amount of money during the evening.
And the counter-example, which is interesting, as you know, was a jury in Hoxton, East Netherlands, where they launched a competition for 19 houses environmental friendly, with certain rules, physical rules, and their architectural rules, because they said that each competitor has to obey to the rules of the ground, of the site. And the first moment I asked, who did write the rules? We did write the rules, so you have the right to change it. Just try to change them to publish immediately that you will change if the competitors ask it, because that's a competition, it's not a common job. So you have to hope to have different propositions. If you close the possibility, you have not. Well, very politely they didn't answer. Then the day after the meeting, the first meeting was that they didn't move the thing, and we have to judge on the propositions already, like work, to show how they could handle the thing, And Hans Peenenbrock, I don't know if you know him, is a very interesting architect. We worked in the Colonia house and I had with him. And he proposed for his proposition that was everything that he already did, everything that he designed and built, was his proposition, saying that he always works with inhabitants, so he can't propose a scheme for a certain place without the inhabitants, because when they will come, they will change the scheme, so it's not worthwhile sharing. So he showed photographs of what he did in the last years, and his photographs, you say, he's sympathetic. Just that. That's a good candidate.
Mm.
He promised to do something which has the same quality as the other.
Well, you see,
this is not a project for that tree. It's a between-tree project. And then there was a conflict between, we were three members of the jury, and we chose three projects. The second day of the third meeting, we had to choose one of them. So there was the conflict. Because they said, he doesn't obey to the rules of the site. We don't know if he's obeying or not. He's clever enough to obey. No, because he doesn't prove with the design. So he was cancelled. And I said, say, give me the text. But there they were this honest, terribly.
In German, difficult. Their composition rules are very difficult. Yeah. It has to be how it's produced architecture. This is, see, you get I think it's all over the world the same. And normally you get a square meter and you are not allowed to be more than 5% less or more. And you have just to put the boxes together and everything. That works. The project has at least the possibility to become something exemplary.
Yeah, but when you just have those...
I've met a lot of competitions in the last years following the project, and we never ever won a project going so far. We always went beyond the rules, huh? And had various solutions, but always this stupid spray on schools that are built, even if the text of the text of the competition.
Yeah.
It gives you an idea that they want something special. Okay, this tomorrow I will show the way how to build dipole, how to work this unskilled, how to plan with unskilled, with children and so on, just give me how we do physically do it and how we do it, how we get the people to design the houses, because first thing is we have to give them self-confidence. Nobody believes the smaller the children, the more self-confidence they have. Even the main question, we start with what is the most important in your classroom? What is the most important in your house? What is the most important in the school? What's the most important in your town? And only the very, very small children find their right answer. Like, if you ask the 3 year old children, the child, me, I am true. And it's so difficult in a school with, say, 10 years old children, they're in chairs, light, window, toilet, outside, extinguisher, everything what you see, you know? But nobody gets the right answer. I am important. You are important. The class is important. The teacher is important. This is let me start and ask how big I am. And I show you more about how we do it. And as we know that children, or even neoliberals can reach the same length that they are. Giovanni Caetti, like Leonardo, and this is portrayed in this wonderful series. How long can you? Because we measure now 1 meter 52, and he says, you can 1 meter 52. No, I think 1 meter 80. The girls were saying 1 meter 20, and the boys 2 meter. And he said 1 meter 53, because he arrived.
The problem I have as a supporter of all this in putting it across, both in cases like this and in the anthropological examples, is that one is entering a different world, and it requires to be explained. You know, when you do the anthropological examples, you run out of time. I went through the house building rituals just to give you some example. Each one from each part of the world, you have to start again and say, this is how the society is set up, this is how the way they get married, this is what they believe, and it becomes a very long story. And it's only when you have begun to understand all that that you can begin to see what it means. And with this also, just to put it as an image, even just this aerial shot in an architectural magazine, they say, oh, he's doing Silly Style. Or whatever. It's only when you uncover the full depth of the story that you can appreciate what it is. And yet, Mies van der Rohe wins every time, because one photo, one drawing, and every architect can understand. And this is why minimalism has come around again. And, you know, because of the power of the single image, rather than the complexity of the whole story behind it. And the normative always seems to win. You know, we were talking about Neufeld earlier today, because it's easy to have the table of dimensions and apply them. It's easy to have the table of square meters and not to go any deeper and not to allow these complexities. And also there's a fear of untidiness. There's a huge fear of untidiness, of disorder. So those are the difficulties.
That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.